You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
Let's do it later.
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th, hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
We're finally here. We've been planning this for weeks. We're so excited. Tim Horaney and joined by Gavin Ward. Thank you so much, Gavin, for joining us from Carroll McLaren.
Happy to be here.
And he's got his vintage Indianapolis 500 hat on. And you were telling us beforehand that you found that on eBay?
Yeah, this is an eBay purchase. This one's a 1984. It's as old as me. But and I wanted to get one for my birth year.
What's a vintage Indianapolis 500 hat cost?
Ooh, it's pretty variable.
Yeah,
I got it as cheap as $25, and I think I might have spent over $50 for the most expensive one.
Okay,
Tim's seen one of my other ones before.
Oh, yeah.
That came complete with some pins and a sketchy looking stain on the inside.
What do you get that dry cleaned, or what do you, or do you just leave the sketchy stain and go, that's part of the character?
Just roll with it. Hope for the best.
That's awesome.
Like, that's a hot dog stain from 1987. It's part of not coming off.
It's part of the charm.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So I got to say, Gavin, I've been dying to talk to you for many, many reasons. But I think the first place we got to start here is you guys have had a pretty good start.
Yeah. Not bad.
Not bad.
Not bad. Could be better. Could be a hell of a lot worse.
Well, so I want to ask you this because obviously, you know, being the team principal, I don't know. I think you got to be a specific kind of person. And obviously we've seen that a little bit with Netflix and Formula One, and you've got your experience there. How do you stay so relaxed? Like you're coming on this show, hanging out, totally chill when you got, you know, three cars and an entire series to worry about. You have a ton of pressure on you. How do you not just like wind yourself up and snap at people all the time?
You know, it's funny. I think I felt in some ways as much or more stress as a race engineer than I do running the team. It's different stress. You know, it's people stress. It's a little less, oh my God, I'm going to make a terrible change and crash race car stress. you know, but I think it's taken a while. It's taken a while to get there, to be more chilled out. But it's always a process. That's the process. It's kind of trying to have the right level of detachment, mm-hmm. the right kind of centering, so that you aren't kind of living the highs and lows of motor racing, which can be pretty extreme.
Yeah. Now, let me ask you this, because you and Tim go back a long way. Was Tim like that? Or was he, what's Tim like? Like, let's get into it. Cause like, you know, why are we waiting for the end of the show for this? I need to know if Tim was wound tight. If people were like, wow, that guy's really difficult. What a temper on him.
Okay. So Gavin,
total diva. Total
yeah.
Diva. Yeah. Yeah. I thought I was actually pretty good. I helped the team. I helped the team sent the tent up. I did my best never to complain.
Tim was always a happy, nice guy.
Okay. Yeah. Except for, yeah. Well, he's a little embarrassed. Right, he's flushed right now. Oh, yeah. So I think you got him going. Look at him.
Definitely one of the nice ones.
There was one time, I think, where the hell was it? We were racing, well, it was Formula Renault. But you weren't in that series at that time. And I think I got... You know, in Tremblant, where turn one, it's like down, you have that compression and you go, you go up and then you can't see the exit, right?
Yeah.
And then the curbing there, I don't know if it's still the same, but it was like, it's fairly high. It's easy to like high side the car, especially like if it's got downforce or ground effect on it. And the Formula Renault car obviously did. And I got like a little touch, like through the compression at the top, I got a little touch nudge. Can't remember who it was, so I won't throw them under the bus. And the car got high-sided, and so like I couldn't steer, right? And you know, you just go down that big hill and there's no runoff. You go straight into the tire barrier. Straight into the tire barrier. And I think that was the second crash I'd had that year, and we were paying for crash damage, and we didn't have any money to begin with. And our sponsor, they came out of our sponsorship money. Like, so for, we had legit sponsors who had to pay for the crash. And I remember I was so pissed. You know, there's like the woods. There's the woods there. I went into the woods, grabbed the biggest stick I could find, and just smashed the hell out of it through the tree. So pissed. So pissed.
Yeah, I mean, I used to have a bit of a temper earlier on in my career. I did, yeah. Like, there was one time, at Red Bull. It was Spa 2008, I think it was. And I was trackside control system engineer. So my big thing was I was in charge of the standing starts we did. Mm-hmm. And I was on, both cars at that point. So that was Mark Webber and David Coulthard. And that was an intense and unpleasant year in a lot of ways. And
just because the car wasn't that good yet, right?
Yeah, the car was, we were getting there in terms of performance, but we had, so that was the funny year where Toro Rosso had the same chassis as Red Bull. Mm-hmm. And they were like running like one update behind. But they had a Ferrari engine and we had a Renault engine, which was this genius move that someone had decided to do, which was to pawn off our Ferrari contract onto Toro Rosso because it was some Renault guys that came over and they're like, the Renault engine is the one to have. But they came over, they had left the Renault V10 engine and come over to the V8 era. And not really realized that Renault didn't do a terribly good job of power on the V8. So what we ended up with was basically, we had the Toro Rosso the same car, but had a better engine in it. So, and we had David Coulthard in his last year of his career, and they had Sebastian Vettel coming into his prime as well. So that was also part of the picture. And so we were getting beat by the junior team, and that was not fun.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing that was not fun is that they had messed up the gearbox design in a number of ways. But we were DNF.
Oh, is that important or something?
Yeah. So one, Adrian Newey is not known for giving a lot of space on packaging. And there was a problem with the differential where they had tightly packaged that. The bearing was undersized and it kept breaking. So then we had that. But there was another problem which particularly affected me as the guy in charge of starts, which is they hadn't designed the gearbox oil sealing correct. So we were leaking gearbox oil habitually onto the clutch, which if you're trying to do a start and you're relying a lot on clutch slip and the consistency of that part, really doesn't help your situation too much. That and the Ferrari, and the thing is at the time I worked for Red Bull Technology, which gave me the ability to look at both Toro Rosso and Red Bull data. Mm-hmm. And I could see like the Ferrari had like a better power curve for starts and they didn't really need to rely on clutch slip as much because they could just drop the engine to low revs and pull away. So they were kicking our ass at starts, the same car. And I'm trying to fight this argument about clutches and oil leaks and people don't really believe me. But we also, honestly, the culture there at that point was terrible.
It got
a lot better. But at that point, it was toxic. And I was like, I was 22 years old or something.
Jeez.
And I think that probably didn't help. I'd walk into the garage and like mechanics were just the mechanic engineer thing there was off. So anyways, this is a long story, but
no, hey, it's a podcast. This is perfect for a long story,
but you can tell me to shut up at any time.
No.
So then I'd go into the garage and like, people were just straight up nasty. There was a lot of people that didn't really want to be there that just got kind of sour over the years. Believe it or not, it can happen. And so the starts were bad. We kept having all this oil on clutches. People didn't really believe me that it was a problem, but I was pretty sure it was. So you're trying to fight that argument. People are going behind your back, trying to like wash clutches out in WD-40 and stuff like that. And
hold on. So they're basically actively sabotaging themselves.
Totally. Yeah. 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 And, or you just get like these acts that you tell someone you need to change a clutch and they fucking slam wrenches on the ground and call you all kinds of names or whatever. Or, it was a hostile environment for me. And I also hadn't really learned too much about how to build relationships with people at that point. So I think there was some of that was on me. But there are times, I mean, honestly, I walked in the garage once and asked somebody to change a sensor because that was my job. I mean, it's like control systems. Basically, we were like live on these sensors that you need to run the car. Like there's certain sensors on an F1 car that you can't run without gearbox position or something like that. And I think I told someone that we needed to change a gearbox barrel pot position sensor. And I had a mechanic pull down his pants and slap his bare ass at me. And I was like...
Okay.
I was like, yeah. So anyway, you'd go into the garage and you're hanging up your radio after the race on the radio rack, and someone would go up to you and smack you on the shoulder and be like, "Hey, nice work. You fucked our race." You know?
Wow.
And it was like,
wow.
So this was like this. That's the background. So I might feel like under a lot of pressure. But one thing I'd figured out was there was a loophole in the old start rules to do with, because it was manual starts, but they weren't. You had like a specific driver pedal map. So you mapped basically throttle position, engine speed to torque demand from the engine. So, and you could, there were rules about maximum gradient. This is F1 stuff. F1 just puts rules to everything to the nth degree, right? But there was rules about maximum like gradients you could have so that you couldn't do like pseudo traction control or rev limiter control in that map. But they only applied above a certain RPM. And in our wet starts, you didn't need as much torque because not as much grip in the wet. We could drop below that threshold. And then we didn't really need the clutch. We could do a kick-ass wet start. So like wet starts were like the only saving grace I had in my toolkit. Hmm. And we had this wet start at Spa. It was raining, and for some reason or another, DC just got like the heebie-jeebies about doing a manual start or doing the start.
DC being David Coulthard, for anybody that didn't pick up on that.
David Coulthard, yeah. Yep. And, you know, I think it might have been that, like, there was a lot of things. You could go on and on, but, like, I think our start on, you drive out the pit lane, you do a practice start on the way to the grid, and that one, I think we were, this is, now, if you're around an F1 garage on the morning, when the engines fire up, they do something called a clutch scrub, where they basically have the mechanic stand like hard on the brakes, and they initiate a sequence on the steering wheel where the thing like will slip the clutch basically against the drive the clutch slipping against the brakes with the revs up, and it's just trying to put heat through the clutch. So it's carbon-carbon friction. It's got a process where it absorbs moisture from the air. You need to like get through this desorption point. Anyways, it happens on aircraft brakes, which are the same design. They call it morning sickness on the brakes, where they don't really work until they get a bit of heat in them. So we hadn't figured that out yet. So we just did that. Like we went through that process on the first start where like the clutch was terrible. So anyways, DC got spun out by that. Kind of understandable, but, then he decided he was just going to like basically make it up and do a start like he used to do on F3, which is like you slip the clutch against the brake and then go. But that is like super slow reaction time for like Formula One level starts.
Right. Yeah.
Anyways, so he decided on the grid he was going to do that. He told his race engineer, no one told me. So I just watched the start and I'm like thinking we're going to like have a decent start for a change. And then nope, we went like, we got hosed, like absolutely, like just swarms. Like, oh, goddamn. I was like, what the hell just happened? Like, what was he doing? Anyways, long story short, no one told me after the race what happened. We're in their debrief in the engineering truck, and like DC says, like his race engineer says, yeah, David said he was like going to do a manual start, and I didn't tell him not to, so did that, you know. And he's like, and then DC said something along the lines of like, yeah, I thought I did a pretty good job, but then everyone drove past me.
How does that go over in the room, Gavin?
Oh, well, that's when I snapped. So this story was about my temper problem.
Yeah.
And I got slammed the shit out of my laptop lid, yelled, fuck this, and walked out of the fucking... My laptop never worked again. It's broken.
You know, it's funny watching hard David Coulthard on TV. I wouldn't think he would be that frustrating. That's very funny.
Well, you know, I've learned to deal with... Now I don't. I tell that story because it's like a lot of young engineers, they live and die by the results, and it's such a big deal. But yeah, that is just not a healthy place to be.
Right.
You know, you have... And it comes from the right place. It's because you care. But like, my team manager took me aside and kind of had a word with me. And it's a speech I've repeated to someone else, a few people since then, which is along the lines of like, we've all got our frustrations. Like, I get frustrated because I can't get parts made for wheel guns to help my pit stops, but we can't all lose our shit over it all the time. We have to find a way to channel, we have to work as a team, and we have to find a way to kind of channel that frustration productively. And then another thing, I was going to quit. Like I wrote out and signed a letter of resignation. And I got called in for a meeting with Christian Horner like a week later. And it's like, I'm done with this. But then I managed to kind of like realize that that was not good timing. Didn't really want to leave on those terms. So I kind of bottled it. And this was something that, and Christian said something to me along the lines of like, it's a people game. This is a people game. And it's how you work with, everyone talks about the race cars, but really it comes down to like how you work as a team and how you work as people. And then I decided I wouldn't quit. And it's kind of funny because it's like, that is like one of those crossroad decisions you make in life. And it's super, like at that point, it wasn't clear that Red Bull was going to be, was ever going to get there. Mm-hmm. You know, we were still had a lot of things that were pretty dysfunctional, but, and it was like, what I came to realize after doing F1 for many years was that usually by the end of what like we used to call the European season, which is the summer season, most people are pretty fed up because it's a gruel. Yeah, the winter, right. Like this was before summer shut down. You were like week in, week out. You don't really get much time off. And like, they're not that exciting races to go to compared to the flyaways. And that was like right at the end of it. So that is, I came to realize that every year you're going to feel a little bit like, this is not that great. And then you go to Singapore, Japan, China, and things are a little bit more fun. And yeah, sure enough, I didn't quit. We ended up, you know, then we went out to Singapore. It was the first year of Singapore Grand Prix. That was really cool. Then we got put up in Thailand for a week as a team, like on the beach, all expensive paid by, you know, the Thai Red Bull owners. And it was like a super fun week where I did a lot of bonding with some of like the mechanics there and started building some more better relationships on the team. And then, you know, had fun in Japan, got through the off season, and then 2009, big huge rule set change. Team crushes it. We've got we win. What was it? The second or third race? You know, we go and win. Like the car, we're fighting for wins, and then almost barely miss out on a championship, but then win the next four. And it's like, geez, if I'd quit, that would have been pretty bad timing. But
yeah. Hey, is that when you noticed like the team atmosphere really changed? Oh, like,
that was the other thing. That was actually the bigger deal. I'm glad you mentioned that. So that was also credit crunch time, mm-hmm. right? So the economy was tanking mm-hmm. in 2008. And what happened in the off season was they had to take, you know, you had Toyota and Honda basically pull out. And they went to like drastic measures to try and cut costs. And one of the things they did is they got rid of in-season testing. So at that point we had a full-time test team. And it's funny. So again, a little bit more of the story. After that race, we had a test in Monza. Mm-hmm. Which was the first time we put Vettel in our car. I wasn't doing tests because I was on the race team, but for one reason or another, there was an issue with the test team engineer where they asked for me to come. So I went to this test at Monza, which was the first time that Vettel drove our car. And two things came out of that. One was Sebastian Vettel was an absolute freaking phenom. Mm-hmm. Like, right away, like, this kid is special. Like, never seen a driver drive like this before. Holy crap, that's cool. No wonder they're beating us. And then the second thing was, I walked into the garage and I was like, we got to change. Sorry, guys, this sensor's glitching. I'm going to need to change it. And it's a whole different crew, right? A whole different crew of mechanics. And the chief, the number one on that car, was like, yeah, sure. No problem. And I was like,
wow, he didn't butt slap at you.
Yeah. Nobody's telling me off. No one's calling me a jerk. Like, then he went back to the hotel, had a few beers with like the mechanics out just outside of the lobby. And like, this is a really cool group. And so the masterstroke that happened in the off season, you know, not fortunate for a lot of people, but it was a bold move by the Red Bull sort of leadership, was that they basically, with the credit crunch and the test team going away, they made everybody on the race and test team redundant, and yet everyone had to reapply for their job, and I had to do the same.
Wow.
Wow, okay.
And what they ended up doing is that almost the entire test team got put on the race team. Huh. And they almost cleaned house. And it was a generally younger group, but a way more enthusiastic group that they had on the test team. So you had like all this fresh blood come in, way better positive nature. And then the team started performing well. The car was good. You put all those things together and it's like, oh my God, overnight we went from like this terrible toxic thing to just like tunes bumping and like this work hard, party hard thing. And then you got some success to celebrate, and winning always helps, you know.
Yeah.
How much of the winning, though, do you think comes from there being good vibes in the garage?
It definitely helps. It definitely helps. The workload we were doing was insane. And like, if you're enjoying yourself, it's a hell of a lot easier to put in that effort. Like, we outworked everybody through those years. That was a thing. It's like, we were winning, but we were the last people to leave every freaking day. And this was pre-curfews, pre-garage hours.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
This was like insane amount of hours, 18-hour days, 20-hour days, you know, like.
Physical labor too, right?
Oh, yeah. We were doing, and this was not cost cap days either. So this was a new floor, new front wing every weekend, testing all these different bits. The carbon guys were so busy, and they were like the strongest characters, and they needed to be. You needed to be a little bit insane to be a carbon fiber guy on the road at Red Bull during those days. Cause like, we had this carbon area and it was like buzz wheels powered by compressed air. Like, and like, it was the soundtrack of the whole year. It was just buzz wheels going nonstop. And like, I remember one, I think it was might've been 2009 or 2010, or it was like 2 a.m. We're at Barcelona in preseason testing, 2:30 in the morning, and all the garage is just like, and because they're cutting and shutting the floor or whatever, like taking this bit on that floor, we test it and we don't put it on that. And it's just, you're always doing that. You test all this stuff on a Friday, and then Friday night, you're like building all the floor, race spec floors to have the right, the best parts on it. And one of the rack runners, so like the day, we call them DAGs over here, but over there they call them rack runners, system engineer, data guy, whatever. He recorded the audio from these like, the carbon shop on his phone, and we had like this kick-ass speaker system in the garage, and just like piped it in and like blared it on the speaker system. Like, so on top of all the noise of the buzz wheels was us, the speaker system also playing noises of buzz wheels. Freaking hilarious. Anyways, those guys would come out of the carbon room and they'd look like they came out of a coal mine, like just dust. Oh, yeah. Dust all over. Yeah. Like, oh my God. It was, it was a hard working time for sure.
No kidding.
It was work hard, party hard. And those guys, like, that was a thing. The professionalism stepped up a lot, though. You just realized that some of those guys were like superhumans. They'd work an 18-hour day, three 18-hour days in a row or something. And if they got away from the track early, there's a bunch of them, like the number ones, they go run a half marathon. And you're like, you guys are insane.
Yeah.
Anyways.
Yeah. I got to ask you, because I talk about it often, but the Mark Webber book is one of my favorites in sports generally, right? Such a great book. Yeah. You know, Christian Horner in an interview comically said that, you know, he was asked about which driver gave him the most headaches. And he went off board and said Mark Webber. What was it that made Mark Webber a special driver? He came very close against Vettel. Obviously you worked with him directly. He seems like a very intense person, but you know, you've worked with a lot of great drivers, Gavin. What was it about Mark that there was something peculiarly different, it seems?
Hear that? Believe it or not, summer is just around the corner. Luckily, Armor All, America's most trusted auto appearance brand, has what your car needs to get that perfect summer shine. Plus, now through May 31st, we'll give you $5 for every $20 you spend on Armor All products. That means car wash pods, protectant, tire shine, you name it. Find out how to get your $5 rebate at ArmorAll.com. Armor All, less work, more clean. Terms apply.
With threats to our nation waiting around every corner, adaptability is more important than ever. When conditions change without notice, quick strategic thinking is crucial. And with obstacles consistently impending, determination is essential in overcoming them. It's this willingness, decisiveness, and resilience that sets Marines apart. With our fighting spirit, we don't just fight battles, we win them. Marines are the constant our nation counts on to fight the unknown. And through adaptable problem solving, we do just that. Learn more at Marines.com.
I love working with Mark Webber.
Yeah. You know,
first and foremost, yeah, and out of the drivers I've worked with over my career, there's two that I think I had really developed really close relationships with. Mark was one, and Joseph Newgarden's the other, over at IndyCar. Actually have a lot of similarities. But Mark Webber is an athlete. You know, he is such an athlete. Some race drivers are more racing nerds, you know, than there are athletes, but he's almost like an athlete first. So he really had a real sports science kind of approach to things, and his work ethic was just awesome. And we managed to build a really good relationship where, you know, the first year I worked with him as a control system engineer in 07, 08, 09, 010 or 010, 10. And then in 11, I moved over to being his performance engineer. So kind of like assistant race engineer, and did that for 11, 12, 13. And that was, so I worked with him for a long time, basically. Mm-hmm. But at the end of 2011, my first year performance engineering with him, we had a bit of a tough year. In some ways, because we weren't as close as 2010. But we had this great meeting at the end of the year where at the time, nobody really talked, and nobody at Red Bull was talking to drivers about driving, really. Certainly not much in terms of sport psychology. It was a lot of, we would spend hours nitpicking every little bit of car performance, but really wouldn't talk about how we worked as a group. You know, the fact that maybe someone said something to the driver and it spun him out in the moment, and then we didn't perform at our highest, or even just shortcomings like we were getting beat on starts. And obviously starts was kind of my bag in the past, but wasn't anymore. But one thing that our own data showed was that Mark had a lot slower reaction time to lights going out than Vettel. Now, some of that's age, right? Your reaction time's slow with age. But it was a problem, and it was worth about a spot on average at every start. You know?
Wow.
So I brought that up to him, and this is like where Mark Webber was amazing, is he went away and brought in his sports scientists he works with, and they like totally reworked his pre-race warm-up routine. We did a bunch of work with focus and how like gaze for the lights that you actually have a faster reaction time with your peripheral soft focus than you do with the direct focus. So changing, like, basically we came up with this method of like looking through the lights, not at the lights. Taking caffeine before a race was another thing that we found. And like, we massively reduced the deficit on that. There was always going to be something we probably wouldn't get with age, but like it went from being like, well, this is destroying us to like, this is a small thing. And that's the kind of stuff that Mark was just like, so freaking good at. And you know what? I think those two drivers were really complimentary when they first started working with each other. Okay. One thing you'll find in every F1 team, I think, when push comes to shove, if you have two good drivers and you have a dominant car, then F1, it's going to be hard for them to be friends, because whoever wins out of those two wins a championship. If you have two good drivers and the car is a piece of shit, sometimes they get on because it doesn't really matter. If you have one great driver and one subservient, they tend to get on because there's not really any challenge. But when you have two guys that can take it to each other and the car is dominant, so it's not about beating another team, it's about beating your teammate, that is a tricky situation to manage from personality. But one thing that I thought was cool, when Vettel started, he was like, you take the most boring hairpin, 90 degree right, 90 degree left, like these boring corners where you don't think really technique should matter, and he would be phenomenal in them. If you take like the complicated S's, really high speed corners, big commitment high speed corners, Webber was a fucking legend, right? You crush it through those. But they learned off each other, right? Mm. And that raises the bar for everybody. And by the end, Vettel figured out how to do high speed and cornering sequence trade-offs from Webber, and Webber, probably to a slightly lesser extent, learned low speed.
Wow.
And I think that's probably why they evolved to be a little bit more different.
At first,
they were closer.
Would Mark do the brake and throttle at the same time? Like,
no, and that's ultimately where I think they grew apart.
Right.
And I remember having this chat with him, because it was in the exhaust effect days. We talked about this another time, but basically,
yeah,
Vettel has a style I hadn't seen before or since, but I have heard other people say that Schumacher
did do it when he was with Ferrari. Yeah.
Which is, it was almost like he drove with his feet more than his hands. And it's like, he would do a lot of, if he had a moment of instability, say you're braking it, say you take a typical slow speed corner, I'm braking hard. Typically as a car slows, the point where like you tend to have the most instability on an F1 car or an Indy car is that just starting to turn the wheel in point. You brake really hard when you got the downforce off, then you start bleeding the brake off as the car's slowing down, it's losing downforce. And as you're turning in, you tend to be like on the rear, or you're getting a lot of movement. And in that instance, if you're overstepping on the rear, usually you'd find the driver's like back out, you know, opposite lock, but not really, but just reduce the amount of steer to correct. And when they do that, the car kind of like loses positioning. a little bit, which leaves them with more turning to do later in the corner, which tends to screw the exit, tend to lose time. But Vettel had this thing where once the rear started to move, rather than like correct the steering, he would actually dab the throttle and throw lock at it and like over, just go over top of the front tire. And so he put understeer in a really unusual way. He would stabilize the car basically by jamming the brake bias forward, because by putting the throttle on, you're effectively doing that. And then going over top of the front tire. So, and that's interesting because you don't lose, like that correction method didn't really lose positioning. So you watch the video and you can see like he's able to correct that oversteer without really screwing the rest of the corner trajectory wise. But the thing that made it a, that worked pretty well in 2009, 2010, but go to 2011 when we put exhaust effect on the car. Now, not only is he like have a nice way of correcting it that maintains trajectory, he's picking up a ton of downforce because like the throttle pedal is downforce. Yeah. So now, and he's carrying that downforce all the way through the corner. And then the other thing that I thought was interesting about that, he would be able to run a car that was inherently a lot more neutral. And with this technique that could put a lot of stability into a car, he could basically, you go around a lap, right? And you'll understand this, Tim. It's like some corners are going to understeer. Some corners are going to be like, I usually, if I'm debriefing with a driver, I always want to go like, where do you have the most understeer? All right. Where do you have the most oversteer? Where's the rear weakest? Where's the front strongest, you know, or front weakest, sorry. And like, by doing that, you can kind of like, you're always trying to play a little bit of a trade-off game.
Yep.
But if I can drive in a way where I can add a lot of understeer in areas, then I can basically take the understeer out of that other, that corner that might be the outlier to the bad. And I think he had a great ability to do that with his technique. Interestingly, when they went to brake by wire in 2014, you know, since then, I would say, that was really to, and they took away exhaust effect. I think that was really to Vettel's detriment.
Yeah.
Wow. But going back to the Vettel Weber thing, I remember talking to Weber about this technique, and like Weber was kind of, because I wanted him to try it.
Yeah, of course.
And he sort of said,
it's easy to ask, but it's hard to like for a driver to
And he's like, I've been driving this way my whole life. I'm never going to figure that out. And at the time, I was immensely frustrated because I'm like, well, we're never going to beat Vettel. And like in these types of corners. I didn't say that, but like I was immensely frustrated. And I remember talking to Adrian Newey about it. And Adrian was like, don't mess with the drivers. Like, I don't think you should spend any time trying to coach drivers on anything. I think that's wrong. I still think that's way wrong. I've never taken that to heart. I've never put that into practice. But
yeah.
And it really wasn't how the Vettel camp was working either. They did a lot of driver coaching with Vettel. And I learned a lot from those engineers, actually, because they were really good at it. Really good engineers. But I have since learned from my sports science is a geeky kind of side passion of mine, and which is very related to what I do. But in general, like, I take it more than typical engineer background person would be. I'm a lot more into it. And now I realize there's actually, it would have been very difficult to change Weber to drive that way. And it may never have worked. And that's one of those, like, you want drivers that are adaptable. Younger drivers are more adaptable. It might have been possible, but it was going to be, short term, it could have been a lot worse because you're going to take that driver out of driving naturally, which is subconsciously, which is externally focused and to like very internally focused. And if you start thinking about where the way I put it, if a driver starts thinking about where his hands and feet are when he's driving around the track, he's going to drive like a beginner, not an expert. And that's what the research says for anybody. If you swing a baseball bat, if you start thinking about where your hands are going, it's actually, there's studies where they look at what makes people choke under pressure. And so say you're making a putt, you're making a putt under no pressure. Do you think about where your backswing is going? Or do you think about where the ball's going? You think about where the ball's going. when you're like, I need to hit this putt to get my birdie, do you think about where your backswing's going? A lot of the time, yeah.
Yeah.
And then you suck. So
it's a good way to put it.
Yeah.
So that's why I'm not good at golf. Okay. Well,
no. Well, one of the best research things in sports psychology is the concept of external versus internal, or some people call it extrinsic versus intrinsic focus, and what that does to performance of certain, particularly experts. And it's a really interesting thing. But what I realize now is I start telling him how to drive with his hands and feet, it probably wasn't going to be great. Now, could he have figured it out? Maybe, but it was probably going to take, like, it might take years. I don't know. Maybe it's probably, like, not feasible. Then you start to realize, like, actually, how do you optimize performance of the driver? Some things might just not work out with that current rule set. Mm-hmm. You want drivers to be adaptable. You want to work towards it. But, like, the amount of intervention you're going to do has to be quite careful in terms of, like, I want to change as little as possible from a driver's natural style. The other thing is, like, the drivers evolve that style for a reason. And this goes into, like, the goalie stuff. There's, like, Swedish goalie coach that says, like, there's as many goalie styles as there are goalies. And they're, like, the myth of the one perfect style. And I think that's the same for driving. Now, there are some, like, physics, right? I'm not saying every style, like, every technique works. That's not true. There's basics to everything, right? Mm-hmm. But when it comes to, like, some of the more 50-50 trade-off things, well, I'm going to tell you right now that, like, willpower is better at managing a car laterally loaded part throttle than Joseph Newgarden is. But Joseph Newgarden is pretty awesome at backing up an entry and getting a huge exit shot out of a corner in a way that willpower is probably not that good at. So you take a corner in isolation where there's not where you can kind of get the same end result, drive it the way you feel comfy. But a corner where it doesn't suit your style, is it mimic the other guy's style completely? Well, maybe, but maybe not, because, like, he's maybe never going to be able to drive that style as well. So it's like, how much do you want to nudge them out of their comfort zone? Because, like,
yeah, are you maximizing what they're good at, basically?
Exactly. Like, everyone's got their own strengths and weaknesses, and they've evolved, typically the longer they've done it, they've evolved a style that works for them. So some drivers there might have a very in tune vestibular system, so they can feel the yaw of a car and catch a snap early or whatever. And so that will, but as another driver might just have really quick hand responses or be very tactile with what they feel of the steering wheel. So they're going to demand, they'll be able to drive a car with a different underlying stability, but they're also going to demand different feedback from a car. And it's like, maybe that guy, that pitcher's got, or that batter's got better vision, but that one, you know, can swing a bat faster. Like,
well,
their optimal is going to be different.
Like, on your team in particular, you have three drivers with three very different styles. I mean, like Callum Ilott or David Malukas or Alex Rossi's not going to be able to drive a car the way Pato drives a car. So
totally. And I think the history of this team, man, I think the history of a lot of racing teams is that they have actually worsened the divide and the gap in performance of their drivers by, this guy's faster, he's doing this, you should try doing that. You should drive his car, you should drive his way. And then they start out like this far apart and they end up like this far apart.
Right.
Because now they're just
having to think about it,
playing to their own straights. So really what you should be doing is, like, what do you need to be able to perform better? Like, what do you need from the car? Is it you need higher roll stiffness because you feel the lateral feedback and that's how you tell how much grip there is? Or you need, you know.
Is that tough to manage with three different cars? But
you can actually make somebody, and then you start fucking somebody's confidence and they can just end up, like, way down there.
Yeah, so, yeah.
I don't believe anything about everyone should drive the same setup. And I think there's some race teams that do. DTM's big for this over in Germany.
Yeah, they are, aren't they? Yeah.
The Germans can be a little rigid about some things. And,
No.
And maybe they think they know it all, but I don't know. So, when I hear about it, I think it's not going to work. It's not going to work. It might work for one person, but it doesn't work for getting the most out of everybody.
How do you manage that with three different drivers, Gavin?
I think it's about convincing people that it's okay to run different cars, because I think there's a little bit of there and trust in the engineering group. If an engineer feels like they're on the chopping block if they're not as fast, which some do. I mean, I think it's a high pressure performance industry, right? Mm-hmm. Then there is an inclination to be like, here, I'll put that setup on. He's just not as fast. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And it's a bit of ass covering, but it ends up at a worse result. Mm-hmm. So it's about creating an environment where there's some level of trust, a good level of trust.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's about educating, just kind of like anything I can do to make people realize it's more complicated than the thing you find. I think the more you do anything is that it you always realize it's more complicated than you thought. And like, to really nail anything, it's just so nuanced that it's a little bit less about like, this is absolutely the one way it has to be done. And really just talking about the idea that we need to give every driver what they need to be fast, whether that's the setup, whether that's the support network, whether that's the nutrition, whether that's, you name it. Right. So, but I do think the real healthy dynamic you want, and this is an interesting one, and I can't say I've perfected any of this, to be honest, but, but it's a goal, is like, a really healthy dynamic is when you have multiple cars that are like, everyone's showing each other the way in certain areas. And I meant to talk about that Weber-Vettel dynamic. Mm-hmm. You end up with two better race drivers because of the strengths. And like, that can really be the way. If you've got a driver who's like really good in high speed, and another driver who's good in low speed, and like, if different drivers are set in quick sectors, everybody can kind of like evolve up. And if same goes for like setup options, like trying to learn what's driver specific and what's going to transfer. And like, so if I don't want to operate like three individual teams, right? Like that's not what I'm trying to do. Like, and that's a risk of like opening yourself up to the drivers can run different setups.
Right.
All they want is a risk that you can't transfer anything that you learn on one car to the other. But it's how do you, ideally you'd have drivers that they really like the same setup. And if if this guy likes this front damper, then the other guy's going to like this front damper, but it's not always that simple. It's a nice situation to have when you get it. But also you're always going to have to know that's something I think I'll take to the bank that it, or like, sometimes one car is going to be struggling on a weekend and they're going to be like, I'm going to take the fast guy setup. But maybe instead of taking the whole fast guy setup, I'm going to take the bits that I feel like are relevant, and I'm going to keep the driver friendly bits or that offset that we tend to have. So you don't go whole hog and then end up kind of screwing yourself by putting something on that guy just can't drive,
Right. Right. So
I once got a finger in the chest because I was told to copy somebody's setup and I didn't take their front dampers or a rear damper at a certain oval. And you told me you were copying the setup, but you don't have the same dampers on. I was like, well, I tried those dampers and the driver said it was going to kill him. Well, those dampers are.
Kenny Govero, who is a listener of this show, tweeted in because we got some questions for you. And he wanted to talk about thermal. And he said, now this is his opinion, I don't know how you would discuss it, but he said thermal is a bit disappointing. He's also an engineer, so he said great work with McLaren. But what are the lessons that can be taken from that weekend so that maybe they can be rewarded for the remaining championship rounds? What do you think?
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Yeah, I mean, at the end of the day, it was actually quite a lot of testing for us to do. We had a lot of track time before we went to qualifying and racing. So we went in the weekend and even had one of the engineers, a couple of the engineers ask me, it's like, what's our view here? Like, it's a non-point paying event. How much do you want us to focus on nailing the, trying to win the $1 million challenge? Or do you want us to get better for every other road course we go to? And the answer I gave was the answer I give to most things these days is like, well, it's not all of one and none of the other. Like it's going to be a mix. It's never black and white. But I would say err towards what can you learn for the rest of the year? But that's not completely ignore how we do on the day. And anything we do, you know, it's an opportunity to practice what we do, which is trying to make fast race cars. So that's going to help us. So I think we learned quite a lot. You know, I think we really worked through, all, you know, if front wing develop, you know, actually now you probably say if diffuser development is the bread and butter of Formula One performance, then damper development is like the bread and butter of what we do. So, you know, if I was an F1, when I was an F1 and front wings drove everything, we had a front wing at every race. Well, now I'm in IndyCar and we've got dampers to try at every race. So, you know, that's what we do. So we did a lot of work on that. Mm-hmm. Is it the most transferable? Some things will transfer. I was trying to understand those sensitivities, but at the end of the day, thermal's bumpier than a lot of places we go. It actually hasn't really been repaved for quite a while.
Yeah.
And one thing we're dealing with now, most of the IndyCar tracks we go to now are pretty recently repaved. Barber was repaved recently. Mid Ohio got repaved this winter. Laguna got repaved a year ago. You know, Indy Road Course hasn't been repaved for a while now. But getting into the geekery of racing, the aging of tarmac and what that means in terms of roughness and the tire to road interaction is a very big deal. And so what you get with these older, call them torn up, but worn racetracks is that they tend towards bigger degradation and more overheating. Whereas a new repave, and this has to do with rubber and its thermoelastic properties. But anyways, if you take the exact same tire and you put it on different tarmacs, and it will behave like it's hotter or cooler depending on the track texture content. So that's right. Why you see F1 teams going around scanning with lasers to quantify roughness on tarmac and all that sort of stuff. So it's a little bit in its own island, which isn't terribly helpful in a way as a test venue. It's also like makes it so the tires are going off every run. It's a little harder to get testing reads, but we learned quite a lot, I think. And it gives you time to do bigger, slower, like more time consuming changes than we might be able to do on a race weekend. Yeah.
Qualifying. What happened?
Oh man. Well,
no, sorry. It's a fully loaded question. I guess I should preface it by saying, you know, I guess why didn't, the guys go out?
Yes. Those of you didn't watch. Through all the practice sessions, I think we had like top five cars, all three cars, the entire event, and then managed to balls it up pretty bad in qualifying. And so, you know, it's funny. we had, and like I said, I talked about this not even an hour ago in a meeting, where it was like, I sat there and in the engineering office told everybody when Lundgaard went like mega quick in P4, half a second faster than everybody. I'm like, the only thing this tells you, because that guy's not been quick, every session somebody's put in a huge lap, this track is super track condition sensitive.
Yeah.
It's super track temp sensitive and it's super wind sensitive.
Wind, yeah.
So both those things are driving performance a hell of a lot. Said all that, and then we went into qualifying, and it was a real tough call between the peak of the tire. Was it going to be lap two or lap three? And in the first group, Fro, who we've worked with for many years, Felix Rosenquist, or we call him Fro. Anyways, he went fastest. He did it, but he was one of the few that did it on the third lap. Most people did their fastest lap on the second lap. Now, there was a different thing here in the format where you had overtake, 40 seconds of overtake you could use qualifying. Well, that was roughly one lap of like overtake use, and that's 60 horsepower on a button basically. But that meant you really only had one lap where you, like, it's 0.3 seconds, a little bit more worth of lap time by using that. So you're also like, you got to choose what lap you're going to, some IndyCar sessions you can try and do both. Always ideally there's about a 10th of a lap, 10th of a second of lap time and how much fuel you put in the car. And then there's 0.3 on the button, you know? So we had always been second time lap team. We also know Felix has a tendency to be slow on warm up. So didn't necessarily think that would transfer to our cars because he went quick. But clearly a lot of people did. A lot of other teams went for the third time lap. Now, we did our second time lap, finished the lap, red flag comes out. Mm-hmm. So at that point, we're fastest, which is all well and good. But the lap times we're setting were comparatively slow relative to group one. Now, why was that? Well, I don't know. Track's slower. Like, it's slower. But at that point, we've burnt our overtake. So if we go back out, we're going to be 0.3 seconds slower if we do the same lap, which is a lot. So you're thinking, we're not going to get any better. We won't bother going back out. The other thing is, there is a risk to going back out because at that point, you're the fastest car. And exception to your being Rossi, who balls his lap up, he had a good car, but the front worked particularly well for him. He hugged a tighter line in turn eight than he had done up to that point, bottomed out because there was a bump there we hadn't found, and really had to abort his lap. So he didn't really put a lap in. So he had to go back out regardless. He had nothing to lose. No overtake left, so he was going to be like a little bit hosed, but he didn't really set a lap at all. So no brainer to go back out. You could argue, like, well, why wouldn't you just go back out anyways? You're not going to use those tires again? And that's a fair argument, but like, if you cause a red flag or even cause the yellow flag that impedes another driver, you lose your time. So, you know, do you want to go back out there and end up throwing away the pole time when you think there's no way I'm going to improve because I got 3 seconds, I got 0.3 of a second of overtake I'm not going to have? What we realized a little bit too late to do anything about was that the wind picked up massively between group one and group two. That was one thing. What was really hard to react to, because we realized that while we were sat there while they were cleaning up the red flag mess. What we didn't realize is basically as they launched the cars to go back out, that wind died down. So you just watched, you could feel it. And you look around, you're like, oh, shit. And then at that point, it's too late to do much about it. You're kind of hoping that your time's good enough, but it became pretty clear the track got fast again with the wind come back down. Also, the track cooled off by 5 degrees, which, Fahrenheit, American. but so, and 5 degrees of track temp at that track temp range through the whole time we've been there was very sensitive. So yeah, basically all that being said, track got way faster. People beat us even without overtake. We would have been faster to go back out, I don't doubt. So real shame, but it's one of those things is like, you could sit there and think, well, aren't we a bunch of idiots? And Captain Hindsight, the whole thing. Or, you know, you can kind of just be a little bit more, what I think is fair is that what I said to the team is, like, it's always easy in hindsight. We got a lot of smart people here. This team's working as, like, we tested in Barber early last week. We were fastest cars on track. Team's working super well. This whole weekend, we've been doing nothing but making better race cars. You know what? Sometimes things aren't going to go your way. It's easy in hindsight. You could beat yourself up, or you could just focus on the fact that we're putting, you know, this is not even a points paying race. Mm-hmm. Let's try and learn from it if we can, but let's not beat ourselves up too much and move on.
What do you think about that, Gavin? The non-points paying like race stuff. Like, I like the idea that IndyCar is trying new things, and I think that's a very positive direction for them. But like the fact that it wasn't a points paying position. I mean, some people just like, I'm not going to tune into this. I mean, it doesn't really matter in the grand scheme of the season.
It's not for me. I personally think we should go race for points.
Yeah.
We can try things, sure, but there's certain things I love about IndyCar. Mm-hmm. One is that it's very open and inclusive for fans, and we didn't have that at Thermal, and I think that's a shame. And the other thing is, like, the racing product's pretty good in IndyCar. Okay, yeah. We had a fuel save race in St. Pete. It wasn't great. I've got some ideas of how we can make that better. But for the most part, our road course races are pretty awesome. So I don't really think that taking pit stops and taking the strategy differences out of the show helps the show. And I don't think that you have the right incentives. Okay, it's great to win a bit of money, prize money. But the prize money only incremented up from in the top five. Mm. So, like,
yeah.
Like, one thing I said after the race, I got asked about my feedback for the format. It's like, it's kind of silly that I'm sitting there in sixth with Newgarden, or I think it was Newgarden, with a bunch of push to pass behind us, and people are worried about losing the position. And I'm like, well, I'll be honest with you. You can let them buy. It doesn't make any difference.
Yeah.
There's no points. There's no money.
Yeah.
The worst thing you can do is crash.
Yeah.
So don't do that.
I know we got to get running here, Gavin.
Yeah.
We really appreciate you taking the time to do this. I got one quick question for you. I spoke with Daniel Ricciardo a little while ago, and we were talking awesome. About you and a bunch of other things. We talked about the 2014 Canadian Grand Prix.
Yeah.
A race in which he won, and you were on the box for him. In the evening, after race victory, apparently there was a party. And at the time, Danny Rick was really enjoying whiskey sours. So my question is, were you enjoying whiskey sours as well?
May have had a few whiskey sours. I love working with Daniel. Honestly, we had a blast. Despite the fact we grew up like opposite ends of the planet, Daniel had a real passion at the time for like Canadian and like really Toronto and the Greater Toronto metropolitan area rooted screamo bands, which was a little bit my scene back in the day as well. And that was a random thing, having Alexis on Fire. He's a huge Alexis on Fire fan.
Yeah, he's huge.
In fact, in 2014, when he won the Canadian Grand Prix, he had the Alexis on Fire heart skull on the back of his helmet with "We Won't Forget You" written on it.
Wow. That's pretty cool.
Yeah. So that was cool. That was a bonding thing. Whenever we were like doing a slow change and testing or something like that, and he'd be like 20 minutes, like, "Do you want to get out of the car?" I was like, "No, I'll sit in here." I'd pipe up some Alexis on Fire, play it over the intercom into his helmet. So he'd have something to listen to. So yeah. Amazing. Anyways.
Amazing. Well, listen,
Gavin, we really appreciate your time as always. There was a list of questions we didn't get to. We'll just get to them next time. But I got to tell you.
Yeah, sorry. I blabber on and on. So.
Nah, it's all good. We love the stories. thank you for all the insights and thank you for the time. We know that as relaxed as you are and easygoing as you are, that you're extremely busy. So the fact that you make time for us is awesome.
Yeah, thanks again, man.
No worries. It's fun to chat.